Of the 55 men who formed the Constitution, 52 were active members of their church. Founding fathers like Noah Webster, who wrote the first dictionary, could literally quote the Bible chapter and verse. James Madison said, "We've staked our future on our ability to follow the Ten Commandments with all our heart." These men believed you couldn't even call yourself an American if you subvert the Word of God. In his farewell address, Washington said, "You can't have national morality apart from religious principles," and it's true. Because right now we have nearly 150,000 kids carrying guns to these war zones we call public schools. In the 40s and 50s, student problems were chewing gum and talking. In the 90s, rape and murder are the trend. The only way this nation can even hope to last this decade is put God in America to the ground. The only hope for America is Jesus. The only hope for our country is you. We repent of our way. Abe Lincoln said, "The philosophy of the schoolroom in one generation will be the philosophy of government in the next." So when you eliminate the Word of God from the classroom and politics, you eliminate the nation that Word protects. America is now number one in teen pregnancy and violent crime, number one in illiteracy, drug use, and divorce. Every day a new Holocaust of 5,000 unborn die, while pornography floods our streets like open sewers. America's dead and dying hand is on the threshold of the church, while the spirit of Sodom and Gomorrah vexes us all. When it gets to the point where people would rather come out of the closet than clean it, it's the sign that judgment of God is going to fall. If there's ever been a time to rise up, church, it's now. And as the blood-bought saints of the living God proclaim, it's time to sound the alarm from the church house to the White House and say, we want God in America again. America to stand up and proclaim that one nation under God is our demand. And send this evil life shall back to Satan where it came from. And let the Word of God revive our dying land. For Jesus Christ is coming back again in all his glory, and every eye shall see him on that day. That's why a new anointing of God's power is coming on us, to boldly tell the world you must be saved.
Good evening, Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station. They're my views. The views of our guests and the views of our callers. Of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But we ask you to hold your calls for a few minutes. We have with us Mr. Stephen Push, and Mr. Push is the treasurer of the Families of September 11th Incorporated, a Washington, D.C. based corporation. And of course, he testified before the Senate and House Select Permanent Committee on Intelligence on the 18th of September of this year. What is really a little disturbing is that although I've seen mention of his testimony and that of Kristen Breitweiser, who testified the same day in the major newspapers, the details of what they talked about has not been brought out. And I think that this testimony was very, very important to our understanding of the events of September 11th of last year. Because those events, of course, led to our war with Afghanistan and now are being used to justify our attack on Iraq, a preemptive strike on Iraq, which I fear may well enlarge to a much larger war. In fact, it could be a prelude to World War III. But under any circumstances, if we don't understand the past, why we are condemned to repeat it. And so with that, I want to introduce Mr. Stephen Push. Thank you so much for being with us again this evening.
You're welcome.
Well, you know, your wife was on the plane that actually crashed into the Pentagon, wasn't she?
Yes, she was.
And, of course, you've been working with the families, trying to bring out the facts about what transpired that morning of September 11th. And in your testimony, you talked about a couple of gentlemen, a couple of Arab terrorists who had actually been known by the FBI, by the CIA. They'd been following them for some time. Would you like to tell us the story about these two gentlemen?
Sure, except I don't think they were gentlemen.
Well, I you're absolutely right.
But,
they were. I wished I hadn't said that.
there were two. Two of the hijackers on my wife's plane were known to the CIA as early as January of 2000. They attended a conference of terrorists in Malaysia, and in fact, the CIA knew that at least one of them had a multiple entry visa to come to the United States. And even though these two individuals were spotted by the CIA. And the CIA knew they were headed for the United States, they were never put on the terrorism watch list. In fact, they were, after the after the bombing of the USS Cole in October of 2000, the CIA realized that one of the planners of the Cole attack had met with these two hijackers back in Malaysia. And still, even after learning that information, they still didn't put them on the terrorism watch list.
And, of course, then they came into the United States, and after they'd been here for some time, why the CIA told the FBI about them and asked them to track them down, what was that story all about?
Well, they not only came to the United States, they came and went at will, leaving and entering the United States. And finally, in the summer of 2001, just months before the September 11th attacks, the FBI became aware that the CIA had been tracking one of these individuals, and was very concerned, and literally begged the CIA for information about them, and was refused. The CIA refused to tell the FBI who these individuals were or why the CIA had an interest in them. And at one point, the FBI officer who was asking for this information was complaining that this was outrageous and that people were going to, you know, might die because of this. But his words were unheeded. Finally, only in late August of 2001 were these individuals put on the terrorism watch list.
By the FBI then?
By the CIA.
Oh, by the CIA, okay.
And, but by then it was too late.
Well, now, didn't the CIA at some point ask the FBI to try to find these men? And
yes, and on August 21st, 2001, they finally asked the FBI to try to find them. And in fact, during the period that these two terrorists were living in the United States, they were actually living with an FBI informant. And yet the FBI agent who was responsible for handling that informant never showed any curiosity about who these men were.
So here are two of the hijackers. They're living with an FBI informant, and actually one of them had his name in the telephone book in San Diego, they both boarded the planes on the morning of September 11th using their own names, and there is an airport watch list. Now, why weren't their names put on that airport watch list?
Well, it's not clear, but apparently the watch list was never given to the airlines. Or if it was, they never checked it, because these two, you know, finally on August 21st, these two terrorists were put on the watch list, and yet they boarded with using their own names. So clearly there was some disconnect there. Either they, you know, I suspect that the airlines were never supplied with the list.
All right, fine. So there are many, many terribly lingering questions about what happened and what the events had led up to that. When we talked before, you told the story of a gentleman, a Marine, who was in charge of security at Morgan Stanley in the South Tower. Now, for those listening, you remember, of course, the plane first hit the North Tower, and, of course, you know, the flames and people jumping out the windows are just a terrible, terrible situation. And yet, of course, the announcement comes in the South Tower, well, you know, don't evacuate the building, just stay in the building. And, of course, had they actually evacuated the South Tower, they could have saved so many, many lives. But, of course, even though the Port Authority, which controls both the airport and the World Trade Center, knew that there was another terrorist plane heading to New York, they did not evacuate the South Tower. But there was one man who really knew what it was all about. Do you want to tell that story?
Yes, this is the story of Ray Rescorla, who is a Vietnam veteran, a former Marine, who was head of security for Morgan Stanley, a company that had 3,500 people who were on the top floors of the South Tower. And Mr. Rescorla was hired in the early 1990s, and he, in fact, predicted both of the attacks on the World Trade Center. When he first took the job, he examined the World Trade Center, went down into the garage and looked at it, and he complained to the Port Authority that someone could take a truck full of, you know, full of explosives and drive it into the garage, park it near the load-bearing wall in the basement, and bring down both of the towers by blowing up that load-bearing wall. At first they dismissed him, but he was persistent, and he continued to agitate for some changes. And finally, they agreed to put in a barrier that would prevent any vehicle from approaching that wall. And in fact, it was that change in the design of the garage that probably saved the World Trade Center from a collapsing in the 1993 attack. And after that attack, Mr. Rescorla looked at the buildings and he thought to himself, the next time they're going to use planes. He wasn't clairvoyant. He was just someone who, he was in military intelligence when he was in the Marines. And he was just someone who had trained himself how to get inside his enemy's mind and try to think like the enemy thinks. And sure enough, when the World Trade Center was attacked on September 11th, even though the Port Authority was telling people to stay put in the South Tower, Mr. Rescorla knew that it was not an accident, knew that it was a terrorist attack, and knew that the South Tower was also vulnerable. And so he ran up and down the halls of Morgan Stanley, countermanding the order, telling people to evacuate immediately. It was thanks to his resourcefulness that all but three of the 3,500 people who worked for Morgan Stanley got out of the building that day. Unfortunately, Mr. Rescorla and two of his assistants, realizing that three of the Morgan Stanley employees had not gotten out of the building yet, ran back into the building to find them, and that's when the building collapsed and they died.
Well, I think that, I mean, obviously he took a tremendous risk at countermanding the authorities, the Port Authority, but of course he was right and they were wrong. Had that not happened, they would have lost twice as many people in the collapse of the building. And this
right.
is really, I think the lingering question is why the Port Authority did not order the building evacuated. Certainly, the situation is such that, although most people don't understand, our military was on the highest level of alert. They knew an attack was coming, and if you had heard Kristen Breitweiser's testimony that morning of the 18th when Mr. Push testified, why, I mean, it was so obvious that they knew the attack was coming, and yet, of course, they didn't do any of the logical things to have protected the lives of American citizens, and specifically, of course, the evacuating the South Tower.
They certainly knew by 9:05 that morning. They had to know that, they certainly knew that the country was under attack. That's when the second plane hit the South Tower.
Now, of course, your wife was in the third plane that was headed towards the Pentagon.
Well, that's what I can't understand. The third plane was hijacked. They knew that a second plane had hit the South Tower. They knew we were under attack. Air traffic control knew that there was at least one other plane that had been hijacked that morning, Flight 77, the flight my wife was on. Despite that knowledge, and even though an hour and 5 minutes elapsed, 35 minutes elapsed between the time that second tower was hit and the time the Flight 77 hit the Pentagon, and yet there were no military jets defending the airspace over Washington.
Yeah, and despite the fact that they were on the highest of alert anticipating the attack, and as Christian Breitweiser brought out, from the time the first plane was known to be hijacked until the third plane hit the Pentagon was almost an hour and 40 minutes. Now, an hour and 40 minutes, we're under attack, we're at the highest level of alert, and there are no fighter planes defending our nation's capital?
Not one.
Not
one. And Andrew Air Force Base is literally a few minutes away from Washington, D.C. by jet fighter.
And there were no planes in the air. And, of course, these are the lingering questions that I'm sure the families and other thinking people are asking. And yet, of course, one of the really most striking and really shocking things today is the fact that the administration is doing everything they can to block an independent investigation. Now, certainly the families of the victims want an independent investigation, don't they?
Yes, we do. We've been lobbying for the better part of a year now to get an independent commission appointed to do a thorough investigation of the events leading up to September 11th so that we and all the American people can know what happened and so that actions can be taken to try to prevent a similar tragedy from occurring in the future. And after a long, hard struggle, we've won the support of the overwhelming majority of both Democrats and Republicans in both the House of Representatives and the Senate, but it's currently being blocked by the White House.
And, of course, they have actually gotten one of the congressmen, I believe it's Representative Porter Goss, who heads the House Select Committee on Intelligence, and he refuses to allow the bill to go before the House of Representatives, despite the fact there's overwhelming support for it.
This is a shocking thing. I mean, this is an insult to our founding fathers, who created three branches of government to provide checks and balances in power in this country. And even though both the House and the Senate have voted overwhelmingly to establish an independent commission, one congressman is using his power as chairman of the House Intelligence Committee to pander to the White House and block the commission for the benefit of the White House, even though he himself admits that he agrees with our position on all of the relevant issues.
So why is he doing what the administration wants rather than what the people of the United States and his constituents want?
That's a very good question. I don't know what power the White House has over him. The commission that we want, the plan is to make it part of the intelligence authorization bill. And Representative Porter Goss, who is holding up this bill, says his concern is that he won't get his bill passed, that his bill will become mired by the House leadership. But that's a very poor excuse. Well, first of all, his bill is not being passed because he's holding it back. Secondly, even if it did turn out that the Republican leadership of the House of Representatives stops his bill on the floor to please the White House, that only shifts the blame from Porter Goss to Tom DeLay and the other Republican leaders in the House. Certainly, there is no reason for any representative in Congress to thwart the will of the majority of Congress to please the president. That's not how the checks and balances in this country were intended to work.
And of course, our elected representatives are supposed to represent us, and of course they're being blocked by the administration. Now, the question has to be raised, if there is nothing to conceal, why is the current administration so intent upon blocking an independent investigation? In fact, everything has been done to slow down this select committee investigation, so they really wouldn't get very much accomplished. Why is that?
It must see that there is something to conceal. The White House is prepared to use whatever power they can to stop this. They've been fighting it tooth and nail from the beginning. They're willing to take great political risk in order to prevent it from happening. Clearly, they're hiding something, and only the White House knows exactly what it is they're hiding, but my guess is that when the investigation finally does take place, we're going to discover that the tragedy of 9/11 was avoidable, and it was through negligence or worse that on the part of our government that we were allowed to be that so vulnerable that day.
Well, though there are a couple of things that have happened. First of all, the administration has made some sort of an arrangement so that if the families promise not to bring any lawsuits, that they will get a significant amount of money. What are the sums of money that are being offered to the various families of the victims?
It varies depending on the family, but the average is about $1.5 million. If you agree not to file any lawsuits.
All right, now,
except against the terrorists, and this is part and parcel of the cover-up, because if lawsuits were filed, then through the discovery process in the lawsuit, we would be able to get access to a lot of the information about what happened that day. And my guess is that this fund that was created to convince people not to sue was in part intended to protect the airlines from bankruptcy, but I think it was also in part to protect the government from scrutiny.
And I think that for our listeners out there, you have to understand that if a lawsuit is brought, then the attorney representing the families can call witnesses, I can put them under oath, and require them to answer questions. And those questions might get into many of the things we've talked about this evening. Why were there no planes there? What was known really ahead of time? Was there any knowledge who these people were? Were they being monitored beforehand? And, of course, the government denies that, but then governments always deny anything that might, bring the truth. So it seems to be a pattern that officials would rather lie than tell the truth. Anyway, here, if you had the lawsuits, why, of course, you might be able to get a lot more information out there. And, of course, the lawsuits would involve the Port Authority, which, of course, did not go ahead and try to evacuate the South Building, the airports and the airlines. And so certainly there are several people that could be sued. What's so interesting is that a number of the families are willing to forego the $1.5 million, realizing they may never get a cent. But they really want the information more than they do the money. Is that true?
That's right. Exactly what they're doing. But the shame is that the Justice Department has intervened in the case and is doing everything it can to block the family's access to government information that they need in order to argue their case.
In other words, even though these people are willing to give up $1 million, and I'm talking about $1.5 million, every one of them, that every family that gets involved, why the government is doing everything and using its power to block here the other route of trying to find out the truth.
Right. Yeah, the Justice Department appears to be abusing its discretion and trying to have information that is needed in these lawsuits classified as secret information, when indeed there is no national security risk involved.
But they always use this idea of it in the name of national security, as if somehow we don't want Osama bin Laden to know what we knew, or Muhammad Atta, or any of the other people who were on the planes. We don't want the hijackers to know what we knew about them ahead of time. No, that's totally ridiculous. I mean, the only national security that would be protected would be to protect people who might be guilty of a heinous crime in our own administration, of knowing this was going to happen and not taking action to prevent it. And then there's another set of lawsuits that involves some lawyers who I believe it's the same lawyers that took the suits against the tobacco companies. And I hate to have lawyers solve problems, but I will tell you that certainly as a physician, I know that tobacco produced all sorts of cancers of the bladder and of the, as well as the lung and several other organs. That has been known for a long period of time, a definite relationship between cancer and tobacco. And yet, the government refused to do anything about it other than, put a little warning on the cigarette packages, which actually protected the cigarette companies. And of course, the lawyers actually went in and they brought suits, and they were able to get very, very large settlements from the tobacco companies, and at least dramatize the fact that the tobacco executives were lying. Well, the same lawyers now have taken a suit against Saudi Arabia, pointing out that our good allies, Saudi Arabia, were financing Al-Qaeda, and of course, by so doing, financing the hijackers' attack on our nation. So I think the suit is something like $1 trillion. And of course, they've named several of the princes highly placed in the Saudi Arabian government. Apparently, they have a lot of documentation of the involvement of the Saudis in financing the Islamic terrorist movement. And once again, didn't our Justice Department intervene to block this suit?
They haven't done so yet, but they have indicated that they're seriously thinking about intervening and asking the judge to either modify or even dismiss the lawsuit on the grounds that it's interfering with U.S. foreign policy, that on the grounds that Saudi Arabia is our ally and families shouldn't be allowed to sue Saudi Arabians over this.
But, of course, if they were involved, and, of course, this would come out in the court, if they weren't involved, why, certainly they should not be allowed to sue them. But that would be determined in court, not by the Justice Department. If they were guilty, shouldn't they be held responsible?
Absolutely. And to my mind, there's absolutely no question that that a number of wealthy Saudi Arabians have been providing major funding to Al-Qaeda. And in fact, the entire Saudi regime is to some extent responsible, because they've created the poisonous anti-American atmosphere that's given rise to this hatred, and that's why 15 of the 19 hijackers that day were Saudi Arabian nationals.
Okay, well, we've got Ed calling in here from Aptos. Hi, Ed, do you have a question or comment?
Any chance of jury involved? And also, do you know of anything about Paul Wellstone? the death of Paul Wellstone?
Well, that's a little off the subject. I really can't comment on Paul Wellstone. What was the other question, Ed? Oh, I guess we lost Ed. Well, that's a totally different issue than what we're talking about. The one thing about Senator Wellstone, he was certainly a liberal Democrat, but on some of the major issues, he really had the courage to take the proper stand. Certainly, he was very much against our coddling of communist China. He very much opposed the idea of a preemptive strike against Iraq because they might be in the process of developing nuclear weapons, but we really can say nothing more than he was a man of his convictions, and I may disagree with some of his convictions, but on some things he was right on, and we certainly feel that his death was a loss to the Senate. We can have people we disagree with, but you can still have people you respect, and I think he was respected by members of the Senate who disagreed with him but still liked him and appreciated the fact that he felt so deeply about what he was doing. Well, let's see. We have somebody else on the line. Is that who do we have on the line here?
Dr. Stan?
Yes.
The first question was, is there any chance of Jerry Spence helping this lawyer?
All right, fine. Thanks so much, Ed. All right, fine. Is there any chance of Jerry Spence being involved in these lawsuits? Do you know, have they talked about him at all?
No, I haven't encountered any talk of Jerry Spence. There are the major law firms that are working on these cases right now are Ness Motley, Spicer Krauss, and Kreinler & Kreinler. Ness Motley is the firm that has been doing the tobacco lawsuit, and the other two are firms that have experience in aviation disasters.
Well, certainly I don't know the other one, but I do know the one that went after the tobacco firms, and I'll say that they did a very, very, very good job, and I respect them for doing something that nobody else could or would do. So they were well compensated for it, but let's face it, that's the way the world makes the world go around. But what they did was so vitally important, and there has been certainly a significant decrease in smoking in this country as a result of it, because I don't think the average individual has any idea how disastrous smoking is. Well, let's get back to the subject we're talking about here, and that, of course, is the attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon on the morning of the September 11th. Did you notice that your testimony and Kristen Breitweiser's testimony, although mentioned, was certainly not covered extensively in the publications, newspapers?
No, it wasn't. That's because it was followed by testimony from Eleanor Hill, which started presenting the findings of the joint inquiry, and it's that was the major news of the day.
Well, I would like to comment for our listeners that Eleanor Hill's testimony, and she is a woman who more or less coordinated the hearings for the Senate Select Committee, and it was outstanding. I had a feeling that she was really very, very honest. She was trying to bring out everything she could. She's limited by the fact she's supposed to be impartial. But I thought her testimony was devastating, didn't you?
Yes, it was. But unfortunately, it's only just beginning to scratch the surface.
I agree with you totally. But for our listeners, we do actually offer that testimony, or it's up on the internet. You can actually get that off the webpage. We're going to have to take a 3-minute break, and we'll be right back here. I will welcome your calls at 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and this is the time I have to mention that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and of course we're dependent on those of you who listen to our programs, who believe that you're going to hear information here you're not going to get elsewhere. And we hope that many of you will decide that you'd like to partner with us in our effort to educate the American people. As you know, our programs are heard now on over 50 stations every week, somewhere across the country. And, of course, we have that unique opportunity of spending 5 hours every day talking to 4 different audiences, bringing them the news behind the news, the story behind the story. And so if you would like to become a member of the Radio Liberty family, of supporters, why, if you'd like to know where, how to get in touch with us, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you'd like a copy of our newsletter, I would be glad to send you one. Our October newsletter is actually simply recording Christian Breitweiser's testimony before the House Select Committee, and I were able to get that on to include all of it in our newsletter. And I thought it was so important, and since it wasn't going to be covered very obviously by the mass media, I wanted our listeners, our readers, to have an opportunity to read exactly what she said. And so if you give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, you'll get a copy of our October newsletter. We'll send that to you free of charge because we feel it's so vitally important to get the truth out across America, the truth that you're not going to get usually through the regular news channels. And so that's what we do 5 hours every day, is try to get people, to get them the alternative news, you might say, or the various congressional testimony or hearings that are not considered worthwhile. Well, I will tell you that the testimony that morning was really very important. Mr. Bush's testimony, who's our guest today, was very important. Eleanor Hill's testimony and certainly Kristen Breitweiser's testimony were really, I think, giving a tremendous insight into what really happened on the morning of September 11th. And then they come along and they have all of this, so much testimony that just doesn't say anything. And it goes on ad infinitum. It's almost like they want to bury the facts in such a big pile of paper that nobody would ever be able to figure out what really happened. And they have had a lot of testimony, which to me was, well, really was simply an effort to say absolutely nothing. But out of all the testimony, there will be a few nuggets of information that are there. And we will try to bring you that information through our ministry, because I believe it's vitally important that we know the truth, that the American people know the truth, because I know we all share with Mr. Bush and the other families of the victims desire to know the real truth about what happened that morning. So again, remember, you can go to our webpage at www.radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. You can pull down our newsletters, and we give you our permission to copy them. You can listen to our radio programs 5 hours a day, either directly in our archives or by going to our affiliated networks, and of course there are links there that tell you how to get to those networks. And of course, once again, we'd be glad to send you a copy of our October newsletter free of charge if you just give us a call. 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because I believe America is truly under attack today. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Mr. Stephen Bush. Our telephone number is 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. And there's so many aspects of this subject that need to be discussed. Now, it's my understanding that there's a trial being held over in Hamburg where the roommate of Muhammad Atta is being tried for complicity in the terrorist attacks, and of course that there is a great deal of access to information you might be able to get there that you would never be able to get here in the United States. What's that story all about?
That's correct. I just found out a few days ago that as a family member of a victim, I have the right to be what's called a co-plaintiff in that criminal case that's being tried in Hamburg. And I can hire a German lawyer, get access to all of the evidence, and have my lawyer question the witnesses and even recommend a sentence. And so that's exactly what I'll be doing, is hiring a lawyer and getting access to that information. And it's very important to get that information, because the German government is not supplying that information to our government, even though we're trying Zacharias Moussaoui for also being a co-conspirator, because the Europeans oppose the death penalty and will not provide any information to the American government in any case where the death penalty may be the outcome of the case.
All right, fine. Now, are you going to independently send a lawyer over or hire a lawyer over there?
I'm going to retain a German lawyer And then I'm going to make all of the evidence that I obtained through that source available to the public.
Well, that's wonderful. Well, now, is there a website that our listeners could go to where they might be able to get more information about your organization or the organizations? Or I think, whether there are four organizations?
There are altogether four organizations that are participating in a coalition to try to convince the government to appoint an independent commission to study the attacks. And my organization is Families of September 11th, and on the web it's www.familiesofseptember11.org. That's familiesofseptember11.org.
And is that F-A-M-I-L-I-E-S?
That's right.
Families of September 11th.
September 11th.org.
And ladies and gentlemen, you really have to get a computer with access to the internet. It gives you access to the information you can't get elsewhere, and you can go to these websites. It's and you can pull down the information, and then you can help us to disseminate that information across the country. Of course, you can go to our website, but we will put links to some of these websites so that you will be able to go there and, of course, get the information, because if the American people really care about what happened, and, of course, the things that are happening now because of what happened on September 11th, if you're concerned about your future, your freedom, your family, you need to have the information, and the Internet is an excellent way to get it. Not only that, but, of course, you can listen to our programs 5 hours a day under the, of course, you wouldn't get much of anything accomplished if you did that, but you can actually get our programs 5 hours a day, and you many times we'll have fascinating guests who will begin to give you information that you're not getting through regular channels. Well, now, of course, you, Mr. Bush, you actually had the opportunity to hear a great deal of the testimony that was given before the Senate and House Select Committees. Was there any other testimony besides yours and Kristen and Breitweiser's testimony and that of Eleanor Hill that was important? There was a great deal of information that her staff put out. Was that important?
Yes. Her staff did an excellent investigation, even though they were hampered by a lack of cooperation from the intelligence agencies.
You mean the intelligence agencies didn't really cooperate in getting all the information?
No, the intelligence agencies have been dragging their feet, and they're playing a game. They're trying to run the clock. They know that this Congress ends at the end of the year, that this investigation will have to be disbanded when this Congress ends, and so they figured if they could delay long enough, they could avoid a thorough investigation. And that's precisely why we've gotten so much support in Congress for an independent commission, because the intelligence committees know they're not going to be able to finish their investigation, and they want someone else to carry on where they left off.
And so, once again, the question comes up is, if there's nothing to conceal, then why are the intelligence organizations doing everything they can to keep our duly elected representatives from knowing all the facts about what happened on that tragic morning? And I think that the families recognize that. But the average individual out across America is so busy being busy with so many other issues that he's not focusing his attention on this. And yet this is really seminal to an understanding of everything. What brought on the September 11th attack? What was known ahead of time? And, of course, one of the fascinating things that I thought was brought out in Kristen Breitweiser's testimony, and for our listeners, Kristen Breitweiser, his husband, Ron Breitweiser, was in the South Tower on that fateful morning, and he'd called her just a few minutes before the tower collapsed and saying, "Honey, don't worry about me." And her testimony really is really very, very touching, which is the reason we've reproduced it. But, of course, she pointed out that according to the New York Times, within a few hours of the attack, now, remember, we're told that the FBI had no idea the attack was coming, had no idea who any of these people were. And yet within a few hours of the attack, FBI agents were at the flight schools where these men had trained. They were in the restaurants where they'd eaten, in the neighborhoods where they lived. How could they do that within a few hours if they had no idea of who these people were ahead of time? After all, they were all dead. How would they have known any of this? And, of course, she asked some very pointed questions in her testimony. What was your take on that thought, this question of how would the FBI have known within a few hours who these men were, where they went to flight school, where they lived, where they ate, if they didn't know anything at all about any of these men beforehand?
Well, clearly they knew a lot more than they were letting on. And that's been the series of revelations that have come out over the last 14 months, is that the deeper this investigation goes, the more we realize how much the government knew about this plot and about the danger of planes being used as weapons, and yet for some reason never connected the dots, never warned the public, and never moved to foil the plot, even though they had some of these men under surveillance.
And I think that is the significant thing. They had these men under surveillance ahead of time, but they certainly don't want to admit that. And then I thought it was so interesting that they have one of the things that is classified, and you know, that nobody can find out, is what the president knew ahead of time. In other words, it's very Eleanor Hill, who actually headed this investigation, made that a specific point, pointing out that the intelligence agencies have classified what the president knew. Now, why should they classify what the president knew? Are we afraid that Osama bin Laden will learn what the president knew ahead of time?
Yeah, it's really ironic that what the White House is saying is that even if the content of the president's briefings has been declassified and is a matter of public knowledge, that you can't disclose the fact that the president knew it before the attack. And that's absurd, because if there is national security information that needs to be protected, it's the content of the briefing, not whether or not the president had the briefing.
And, of course, we were actually been reported a number of times that on the 6th of August, he was told that the hijackers were at least contemplating hijacking planes here, that the Islamic terrorists were contemplating hijacking airplanes. Now, we do not know the content of that briefing, whether there was any mention of the World Trade Center, but we do know that he was told that on the 6th of October, and knowing full well that this was at least being contemplated, nothing significant was done. I mean,
actually, it was the 6th of August.
I'm sorry, the 6th of August. Right. You're absolutely right. And, of course, here it was, almost 6 weeks ahead of time, 5.5 weeks ahead of time. And instead, of course, you know, of mobilizing the National Guard and putting marshals on the planes and putting instructions out that, you know, we were not to compromise with these people under any circumstances, because, of course, they'd been so violent in the past and had killed a lot of Americans. None of these things that were logical would have been done. No planes were ordinarily in the air to protect our cities.
Well, they did do something, though. They advised Attorney General John Ashcroft not to fly on commercial jets.
Yes, I think...
He flew private jets.
Right. Well, we've got Bill calling from Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. Hi, how are you doing, Bill?
Hi, Dr. Stan.
I have a question or comment.
Two questions. One is there any estimate as to how many people would normally be in those towers in the third building at 9 o'clock in the morning?
All right. So the question was, how many people ordinarily would be in those towers at 9 o'clock in the morning?
I think when the towers are fully occupied, there would be 40,000 people there. I believe that when the first plane hit at about 8:45, there were still some people traveling to work, and there were probably about 20,000 people in the building at that moment.
You mean the two buildings?
The two buildings together,
right.
Yeah.
All right. I think that's probably about right, Bill. Any other questions?
Just quickly, the Building 7, or the third building that collapsed, you would think that, at least in New York, the people that are familiar with that building, that there would be a lot of scuttlebutt as to why that building came down. And there is never any discussion of that third building on the media.
The reason that building came down is that there was the emergency management center was in that building, and the emergency management center had a backup generator to provide electricity, which was run by diesel fuel. And there was a large diesel tank, which someone had brilliantly located right near a major structural beam. And when that tank blew, the beam was destroyed and the building came down.
And supposedly there was a diesel, you know, in several places in that building, large amounts, which of course, you know, was in violation of all the fire codes. At least that's the explanation that's given, Bill. Any other questions or comments?
And that was is that a 70-story building?
I think number 7 was 43 stories.
Right.
43. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, thank you so much for calling. All right, fine. And of course, there are a lot. One of the questions that I've had, and perhaps somebody in your group has looked into this. Now, ordinarily, there were 4 planes hijacked, and those are fairly substantial planes. Each one should have, my understanding, should have carried about 250 on average people, and yet there were only about 260 people on all 4 planes. Is there any question as to why there were so few people on those planes?
We believe that the hijackers deliberately selected flights that were not full so that there would be fewer passengers for them to deal with, so it would be easier for them to hold the passengers at bay.
Well, was there ever any question that somebody had bought up a lot of these seats, you know, available?
Bought up a lot of the seats?
No, bought up the seats so that there would not be the people there. In other words, were the flights actually booked full, or were they really not people ordinarily on those flights?
I don't know the answer to that. I believe those are flights. I believe that's why they chose a Tuesday morning. I think a lot of cross-country business travel occurs on Mondays and Fridays, and I think Tuesday is a relatively light day.
All right, fine. That question has been raised, and I certainly didn't know the answer to it at all. Well, then, of course, if you're out there in the listening audience, again, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And, of course, our guest this evening is Mr. Stephen Push. Well, what are some of the other questions that you and the members of the family have, questions that you would like to see answered?
Well, there's a whole series of questions as to why the trade towers collapsed as quickly as they did. And you had mentioned building codes. What we've learned is that when the towers were being built, the Port Authority was exempted from following fire codes and building codes and made a number of shortcuts that made it more likely that people would die. For example, the exit stairwells. Normally, in a building of that size, you would have concrete or brick or cinder blocks supporting the emergency stairwells. In this case, the only thing between the planes and the interior of the stairwells was drywall. And when the planes hit the buildings, they severed the exit stairwells, and that's why almost no one above the sites of the impact was able to get out.
Well, of course, it's amazing how most people need to adhere to the building codes, but apparently when you're a government body, you can get away with some of these things.
That's right.
What are some of the other issues that you're concerned about?
Other issues we're concerned about is aviation security. The common wisdom is the story that's been put out in the press is that before 9/11, people were allowed to bring small knives onto planes. They were not forbidden, and therefore the airlines were not negligent in allowing these weapons onto the planes. I have serious doubts about that. For one thing, we've been able to obtain an internal FAA memorandum, which indicates that well prior to 9/11, the federal government knew that the most commonly used weapon in domestic hijackings was small knives. Also, the document that supposedly says that it's okay to bring small knives on planes, that document has been classified by the federal government, and they're not releasing it to anyone. So even though they claim small knives were allowed on planes, no, you know, no one has been able to see that document to verify if that's true.
Well, I know very well that when I tried many years ago to take a flight with a small pocket knife, it was taken away from me and returned at the at the end of the flight. So I don't know why they would allow the Islamic hijackers to take these on when they wouldn't let other people, like law-abiding citizens like myself, carried, this would be, a 3-inch blade on a pocket knife.
Well, the Federal Aviation Administration has been one of the most scandalous federal agencies. The Government Accounting Office has documented for about 14 or 15 years prior to the 9/11 attack, the General Accounting Office repeatedly documented the poor quality of the work done by the FAA, the fact that people were able, in tests that were done to see how well the system worked, agents were able to get guns, explosives, you name it, onto a plane. They could carry machine guns onto planes, and the screeners wouldn't detect them.
Well, how could they do such a poor job, unintentionally?
I didn't know it before 9/11, but when I went back and looked at the record, I realized that it had been very well documented in the public record that the FAA for years had been doing a lousy job and the airlines had been doing a lousy job of screening passengers and their baggage. To this day, do not screen check bags for explosives.
And, of course, you're talking about the baggage that's put down in the hold. And, of course,
right.
You could put a big bomb in there, and that would take out the whole under part of the plane.
And there's nothing, at this point, there's nothing to stop a terrorist from doing that tomorrow.
And the question is, why aren't they doing what is logical? You know, if we really are at war with terrorism and we're worried about a terrorist attack, you would think that every one of those bags would be opened and checked beforehand.
Because the airlines are afraid that if they make it inconvenient for people to travel, that they'll lose business. They're already losing money. And the government is, for whatever reason, whether it's corruption or an unreasonable fear that the airlines will go out of business, the government has been placating the airlines and allowing them to do pretty much anything they want to do.
Well,
before and after 9/11.
I'll tell you what, having flown on Israeli Airlines, and I believe it was Royal Jordanian, as I remember, they went through everything just with a fine tooth comb before it was checked through. I mean, you got your bags, the ones you'd ordinarily check through, they went through them from top to bottom. And then the people who had checked the flight, checked your luggage, came on the plane with you so that if there was going to be a problem, they'd go down with the plane. That gave them a real incentive to do an extra good job. And I really think that if we are serious about fighting terrorism, why this is what should be done. If we're not serious about fighting terrorism, then we ought to ask the question, why? And, of course, I think that is one question that is not being either asked or answered today. Well, what is the next step for the families? Now, of course, so far, everything is being done to block the independent investigation that you want. Would you like our listeners to either write or phone or fax or Portergas? I think you mentioned to write because of the anthrax scare.
That would be very helpful if people could fax or email or call both the White House and Representative Porter Goss, Republican of Florida. It's the White House and Porter Goss who have been holding up this independent commission, and tell them that the American people want this commission. They want the truth. Perhaps that will help us, and we will be in Washington continuing to lobby when Congress comes back on November 12th. We'll have a few more weeks before this Congress ends to try to break this impasse and get the commission started.
How do you spell Goss?
G-O-S-S.
Okay, that's Porter Goss, and of course he is a Republican.
His contact information can be found at www.house.gov.
All right, so you can go to the internet, www.house.gov, and you can get Porter Goss's email, get his fax, and his telephone number, and let his office know that the American people are looking to him for leadership. And I think that it behooves each and every one of us to help the families of the victims of 9/11 to get that independent investigation that they want. And I think that we need to have to know what really happened before we get involved in a major war in the Middle East, which could lead to World War III. And, of course, there is no such thing as a good war for anyone involved. And the last thing we should be doing now, especially with our shaky economic situation the fact that certainly our Osama bin Laden has said the way to topple America is to topple it economically. And with a shaky economic situation, the last thing we need is to spend another $100 or $200 billion on another war. Well, do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners this evening?
Just that, keep contacting your congressmen and your senators and urging them to continue to press for an independent investigation and continue to press for improvements in homeland security, because unfortunately the country is not much safer than it was on 9/11.
Well, thank you so very much for being with us, and we look forward to doing that program on our Saturday morning program tomorrow. Thank you so much. God bless you, sir. Bye-bye.
You're welcome.
Okay, fine. Well, that was Mr. Stephen Push, who is a treasurer of one of the organizations of families of the victims of 9/11. So we hope you enjoyed the program. We hope that you will take the time to make the calls, the emails, the facts, and to Mr. Portagos and to the president, to let them know that you're very disturbed because they're blocking the will of the American people to learn the truth. And ask that question, if there's nothing to conceal, then why are they so concerned about concealing it? And then, of course, we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for our leaders. We ask you to pray for revival. And lastly, we ask you to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so we bid adieu to our listeners up in the Great Northwest, and we'll be back with you Monday. Until then, may the Lord be with you. Well, good evening again. Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring, and I have to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we always welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us right now Karen Kingsbury, and we're going to be talking about media bias. We're going to be talking about some of the books he's written. Karen, thank you so very much for being with us tonight.
Well, thank you for having me on the program.
Well, now, of course, were you involved with the news media? Were you involved with the magazines? How did you come in contact with the media?
Well, I got my degree in journalism and started off actually as a sports writer, where I didn't really see a lot of bias in that level of media. But I was promoted up to the front page, and I became a general assignment reporter for the Los Angeles Daily News and did that job for a couple years before I ended up getting a magazine article actually that was printed in People magazine. And that was also really not a place that I saw a lot of bias necessarily, and from there I became an author. So it was really while I was on the front page at the Daily News.
All right. Well, tell us about this idea of freedom of the press. Now, I'm sure there is freedom of the press. It's freedom for the people who own and control the newspapers to print what they want to. But of course, the American people honestly believe that we're getting all impartial news, that we're getting news that's not being slanted one way or the other. As somebody once said, I think it was Sergeant Friday on one of the detective stories, just the facts, ma'am, just the facts.
Mm-hmm.
And I know certainly when I was very young and idealistic, I really thought that I was getting the truth when I read the newspapers. But is that necessarily the case?
Well, the people at the Daily News who I worked with were great people. And, they really what I saw anyway in the newsroom at the heartbeat of where all of the front page news took place, it was sort of an expectation to print the news and cover the news with a certain bias. And it was a bias that came from journalism instructors and was passed on to journalism students who then became reporters who then became editors. And, of course, we're talking about a very small group, a group of people who could meet around one table in a small room to determine what the headlines would be for that next day or that next week. And there are a lot of ways you can write a headline, 100 different ways you can write it over one particular news event, and that's where the bias was very, very evident.
You know what I mean? And the way that they put that headline together to draw attention to the article?
Exactly. Polls are a perfect place, and I would see where they would contact, a very small group of people to determine at election time, the candidate that perhaps they favored, and usually it would be the Democratic candidate, that the headline would read there. They were let's say that the poll showed that the more conservative candidate was ahead. Well, then we could always say that the more liberal candidate was gaining ground, or that a favorable shift in the polls was evident. But we would never it would always be the way you would play it would be very, very clearly in line with what their political views were.
And of course, the thing is that something like that can have a very profound effect on an election. I think we're seeing this in the current election today, where of course we have two candidates running for governor, and of course everybody is saying, oh gee, nobody's going to show up at the polls, and it's going to be a very light turnout. Well, if it was a very light turnout, then the people who really are dedicated to one position or another are the ones who are going to make the difference. And if people stay home, why they lose their ability to influence the election. And of course, usually the people who are most dedicated to voting will be the people from the labor unions, because they get them out. They have the people who are affiliated with, say, the teachers union, the Teamsters union. Mm-hmm. They're going to get their people to the polls, and they just assume everybody else stayed home. That way we can have a very effective one-party system.
That's exactly what happens. In fact, you find that if, for instance, the polls are leaning more toward the conservative candidate, you end up finding more and more of these stories that people won't be turning out. That's their way to, and I really think they believe this, that the editors will, kind of sift this information and twist it and look at it and say, well, if the conservative candidate is ahead, then clearly we're showing an apathy because they're not seeing their person with the lead. So Then you have, you know, conservative families. Now let's look at the voters who would tend to vote conservatively. Where will they be if they've been convinced through the news media that there's no point in showing up because there's this apathy that's going on? They'll go grocery shopping or take their kids to a movie instead of voting, and that's what we have to avoid that.
In fact, we saw that in the last presidential election when, of course, in Florida there were two time zones, and the Democrat controlled media, at least the media, let's say the liberal media, let's be nice, let's call it the media, announced, of course, very shortly after the polls closed in eastern Florida, that the Florida had gone for the Democrats. There were a lot of Republicans there at the polls, waiting at the polls, and up around Pensacola in the Panhandle area, which was in central time. And the state had already been declared for the Democrats. Why should they bother to take their time to vote? It wasn't going to do any good because the state was going to go Democratic. And,
exactly.
of course, as you know, the state did not go to Democratic.
Right.
And that's, of course, what gave the election to George W. Bush. But be that as it may, the fact that they would come out with a statement like that without any basis in fact at all, other than to actually have a profound impact on the reality of many of the people who are voting. Well, what were some of the other things besides the voting that was really that you saw that? Did you notice any bias at all as far as abortion or homosexuality or even an anti-Christian bias at all in the media?
Yeah, every one of those biases were very evident, and you would see it in the way that news stories were handed out. Let's take the Christian bias, the last acceptable, sort of bias that there is really in our day, and the last prejudice that would be acceptable. Well, if somebody you were doing an interview on, and this could be an athlete, it could be a politician, it could be the leader of an organization, for whatever reason, someone who was in the news, and you would go out to do that feature story on that person, if the primary pulse, the primary heartbeat of that person happened to be their faith, you could just cross that right off the list. Your editors would say, that is not something we're going to write about, so we won't be talking about that. So find the next thing. And maybe it would be that they studied butterflies, or maybe they had a thing for, you know, kind of watching the planets, or whatever their hobby would be fine, as long as it wasn't that their life was driven by faith. That was not acceptable to write about, and we were told that.
And you were actually told that?
We were told that. We were told that, cut that out, no one wants to read about that, that's too religious. And, you know, we're talking again about just a handful of people shaping the news for millions of people.
And, of course, the thing is that the majority of people do have a deep religious faith, at least a faith of some sort in a God. I mean, well over 95% of the people profess some sort of faith. About 80% of them say that they're Christians. They may only be nominal Christians, but, they certainly embrace more or less the Christian faith. And the fact that, you know, the news editors would put that out would mean that they would have a profound impact on the reality of so many people. And, you know, it's sort of like the program that is so popular, at CBS program, Touched by an Angel. And it's really a very touching program, talks about God. But even though Martha Williamson, who's the producer, is a devout Christian, she is never allowed to use the word Jesus Christ on the program.
Right.
And, of course, in fact, I'll never forget the time that they were going to sing the third stanza of they were going to sing the Battle Hymn of the Republic. And that was sort of the culmination of the program.
Mm-hmm.
And I just sat there. I wondered if they were really going to put the whole a third stanza out there, because, of course, it concludes, as we died to make men holy, let he died to make men free, talking about Jesus Christ,
right,
as Christ goes marching on. And they actually got that in, but I will tell you that was about the only time that was ever allowed. And of course, you couldn't very well sing the song and change the words. That would be too flagrant, even probably for the censors there in the television land.
I'm sure they had a lot of very tense meetings over that. It's amazing what is not acceptable, and definitely the more narrow you get. I mean, faith you might be able to mention occasionally if it was something that you could really make an argument was pertinent, and then it would be buried in the story. When you get that a little more narrow and mention God, more eyebrows will raise, more pens will come out and want to cut that, but Jesus would be off limits. That's exactly what you'd find.
Well, you know, I think that the American people have to understand that there is this bias, and whether you're a Christian or whether you're not, you have to understand that there is an anti-Christian bias out there, that it works at the highest echelons of our organized media today, and certainly that is the reason why I think we're having so many problems today. There is an organized effort to destroy the religious foundation of a nation, and of course every nation has at least some religious foundation or had one, and you destroy that foundation, why you eventually destroy the nation.
That's
and
exactly
of course
right.
This is exactly what they're doing. They know what they're doing, they just don't want the American people to know what they're doing.
That's right. Yeah, the other area that I will never forget was when I was sent out to cover an abortion protest, and actually normally I would have been doing more of the in-depth feature story for the Sunday edition, and this was a Saturday assignment I was covering for someone else, and as such we had Saturday editors at the paper, and Saturday editors always want to be the Monday through Friday editors, so these were guys who didn't want to make a wrong move or do anything that would cause any feathers to ruffle above them. So I was sent up to cover this protest, and I expected to see the things that I had actually read in the paper. I'd never been to an abortion protest, so I'm looking for the, you know, the fanatical guy on roller skates with the placard sandwich board, you know, kind of John 3:16, and just kind of fanatical kind of a guy. I'm picturing him to be there. He wasn't there. I'm picturing that we're going to hear, you know, the people who are anti-abortion would be very violent and at least have very, you know, kind of angry spewing words. That wasn't there. I found instead very quiet prayer groups that were sort of gathered around in circles, and they were praying, and they were very quiet. And then there was a line, almost a very militant type line that was sort of surrounding these people who were the people who were protesting. They were the quiet ones. The people who were around them were standing up. They were waving hangers, and they were saying things like, "Unborn babies can't feel pain," and just chanting a real hateful tone to it. And I closed my eyes and I thought, okay, what is the story here? Where is this? How can I write this in a way I've never seen a story like this written this way? So, you know, I took quotes. I listened to what was very loudly being proclaimed. One group was chanting, "If the Pope could get pregnant, abortion would be a sacrament." And I took quotes from these people because they were so loud, and that's what they were doing. And I took that story back and wrote it, and my editor had sweat. I mean, he was just shaking, like, oh, I can't run this story. And I said to him, you know, I'm one of your top GA reporters on this paper. You have to trust me. You have me in this role, you know, for a reason. And so, you know, he did. He took it, and he was just, we went back and forth over each line of that story, and finally he ran it. And he, I don't know exactly how much he took, but our paper was deluged by letters. And half of them were, you know, vehemently in support of what I'd written, saying, thankfully, you finally found someone who's not biased. And half of them were saying, there's no way, get the conservative right wing off your paper.
Well, I'll tell you what, the other side, there may not be very many of them, but they're well organized, and they're certainly very good at writing letters and intimidating people who don't go along with their agenda.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, of course, are you glad to be now an author rather than a writer, than a newspaper writer?
Well, you know, the funny thing was, I've always dreamed of being an author. But at that point when I was working for the front page and I was seeing this bias, truthfully, I was glad I was there. Because if it wasn't for me, there really wouldn't have been anyone with my viewpoint, with more of a conservative viewpoint, or even a determination to be just honest with what the story was on my staff. I mean, the rest of the people, and they were nice people. But they were so indoctrinated in that entire mindset of liberal media, liberal journalism, that, you know, I would encourage still anybody interested in going into journalism with a conservative viewpoint, go for it, because we could use the balance. So, you know, there are days when I miss it, but I do love what I'm doing now, writing books.
Well, you know, one of the great tragedies of our time is these young people, people who work on the newspaper, are victims of an indoctrination that takes place in college. And,
exactly.
You know, I went to a liberal college. I came out a dedicated liberal. I was 32 years or 33 years old before I ever had a serious thought, in contrast to everything I'd been programmed to believe. And this is really so true of the majority of people. It said, you know, if you aren't a liberal when you're 20, you have no heart, and when you're still a liberal when you're 40, you have no head. And of course, as if this has something to do with emotion, it has nothing to do with emotion. Right. It has nothing to do with hearts or heads. It has to do with indoctrination. Mm-hmm. And usually it takes 20 years or so to undo all the lies that you've been told in your educational process. And the great tragedy is they're using our tax money to lie to the students and not to educate them, because if they were educating them, our students would be a lot better in comparison with the students from other nations. They're not. Our students have the greatest self-esteem, but you can put them up against students from other nations, as far as linguistically and, as far as knowledge is concerned. And, a lot of our college graduates can't tell you what's in the Constitution of the United States to save their souls. And of course, this is the tragedy of modern education, and it was taken over many years ago as a result of the great tax-exempt foundations and their effort to use our high school and college education to change the orientation of our students and eventually the orientation of our society. And I'm sure that these same ideas had infiltrated every aspect of journalistic training, hadn't they?
They definitely did. In fact, my husband is a high school teacher, a public school teacher. But both of us would be the first to line up to say, let's just do away with the U.S. Department of Education, because it's so much an agenda-based organization.
Well, how did you end up coming out, with some conservative views? It sounds like you didn't believe what you were being indoctrinated in. You must have had pretty strong views ahead of time, or maybe you were smarter than I was.
It's a funny thing. I didn't know I was conservative, and I didn't know I was Republican. At a very young age, I just had those views. To me, they just made common sense. Even as a reporter for my high school paper, that was in Los Angeles at that time, the time when they had just started mandatory busing. And, I was not raised in a prejudiced home, whatsoever, that very open-minded home, completely open-minded. And yet, to me, it made no sense that because I was white, I had to be picked to go down to this school an hour away to go to school. And because they were black, they were going to come into my neighborhood to go to school, and we were going to try to say that was equal. How can you say color doesn't make a difference if you're going to then also say, because of your color, you have to go to this school, whether you like it or not? So I wrote an editorial for my high school newspaper, which, from a standpoint to me, that just made common sense, and took a lot of flack from it from the teachers and from the... Didn't realize what kind of political toes I was stepping on, but I had that view all the way through. Probably it wasn't until I was out of college that I started going, my views line up identically with this sort of one side over here, and it just to me was common sense.
Well, of course, if you're trying to do away with racism, you're sure doing a rotten job, because there's a lot more racial hatred in the black ghetto, black for white, today than there ever was, during the old days of Jim Crow laws and discrimination. And instead of course, doing away with the racial hatred, they engender it, and they do it every time they have a chance. If there's a couple of white boys who beat up a black boy, it's on the headlines of the paper. If 50 black people beat up a white guy, they bury the story someplace it's never seen. And everything is done to, play on the sympathy of the whites, and, of course, on the other hand, to inflame the anger of the blacks.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't understand that the media creates our reality and promotes and knows how to provoke our emotions.
Right.
And you saw that in the terrible Rodney King riots there in Los Angeles, and just some of the fury of some of the blacks towards the whites. Fortunately, there were a lot of good, responsible blacks who did save the lives of many white people there who otherwise would have been killed by the raging crowd. So,
right.
And you can't have a society if you have racial hatred.
Right.
And yet the media does everything they can to promote it.
They do. They have a standard line again on that issue. And, my husband's been a basketball coach for 14 years, so we've always, again, just not really ever seen the color difference. And I fully am aware that there's, a plight in the inner city, and that we need to work together. We need to love each other more and have these lines erased. But it's not going to happen, like you said, by the inciting articles and headlines that come out of the media and just spawn hatred between the two groups.
Amen to that. Well, let's talk a little bit about your new career as an author. Why don't you tell us what sort of things you write and what you have written and what you hope to accomplish as an author?
Well, when I took my leave from journalism, I wrote 4 true crime books, and that was sort of a combination of really both wanting to write the books that I'd wanted to write and then also the kind of crime stories that I'd been covering for the newspaper. And one of those was made into a CBS movie of the week. So those books did very well. Then I had 4 kind of answered prayer and miracle stories. They were collections of true stories. But all the while, in my heart, just beat the heart of a fiction writer. I wanted to write novels. Stories were there in my heart that I couldn't wait to get out on the page. And wrote my first novel in 1997, and it was called Where Yesterday Lives, and I tried to get it published by Dell and Berkeley, my New York publishers that were sort of the bigger publishing houses, and I had editors that wrote me back and said, boy, I loved your book, it made me laugh, it made me cry, but you know, there's no vivid sex scenes, there's no language, I don't know what to do with it, we don't know where to launch it. So, really at that point, it was as though, you know, really I felt that God was leading me that there was had to be another place, there had to be a market for what I would call life-changing emotional fiction that was hopeful as well. And made the connection then with Multnomah Publishers. They published my first 6 novels at that point. And after that, I got hooked up with a wonderful agent, Greg Johnson, at Alive Communications, and his belief was there's indeed a market for this, and I have to tell you, since I've been with him, my novels have just done amazing things and have been on the bestsellers list now for the last year within that genre. So it's going very well.
Well, now, who is actually publishing them?
Well, right now, the ones that I have out, I actually have the big houses, the big New York houses are actually taking notice that this is a genre that people are interested in. So Warner Books is one of my main publishers now, and Tyndale Publishers publishes the series that just debuted, which is the Redemption series.
Well, you know, I think that the idea that there's no market for books that don't have a lot of vulgar language and sex scenes in them is a lie. It's like the idea that, a movie won't sell unless it has these lurid scenes in them. And I will tell you that they sell far better. And my friend, I don't know if you know Ted Baer, puts out the movie guide, but Ted has analyzed the movies in Hollywood and has pointed out again and again to the Hollywood producers that the movies that make the most money are those that, have the traditional values that most people embrace. And a lot of these are movies that have the sex and violence and depravity. Most of them really don't make any money for them. They're losing propositions. So, but they do have an impact on the psyche of the American people and, of course, move them ever further down the ladder from altruism towards depravity. But, and I'm sure this is true with the books. I mean, I can't believe the books that were being read in a private Christian school in Greenville, South Carolina, where I was paying for my granddaughter to go to school. These books were so discouraging, so downbeat, full of depravity and hopelessness. After reading one of these books through, I'm 70 years old, I felt like committing suicide. I mean, there was just hopelessness. Have you noticed that in a lot of the books out there?
I really have, and a lot of them that the Oprah Club, let's take those books, and if you ask people who are avid readers of whatever it is that Oprah suggests, we can almost chart it along with what we see as an increase in depression among women. These are books that are, they start out bad, and they just get worse, and in the end, there's no hope at all.
Life is tough, then you die, and no good deed will ever go unpunished, and most people lead lives of quiet desperation.
That's it, yeah. I'm not saying that, the writers of these stories are very talented writers, but, the stories offer us nothing to hang on to, and then they'll make the argument, which is that, the freedom of speech, we have the right to put up stories we want to put out, and that's true, but what we're finding is that the dollar can dictate us back to a more conservative, family-friendly, hope-filled approach. And in fact, Publishers Weekly made an announcement not that long ago that inspirational fiction was the fastest-growing genre in the entire publishing industry.
Well, then maybe you sort of were leading the way in that direction?
That's what I'm hoping, yeah. We're really seeing that. If I could, the letters I get from readers are unbelievable, that they are just hungry for this kind of fiction that will give them a contemporary story where real issues, real types of people, nothing plastic or phony, but so within these flawed people and the issues they're dealing with, there's hope and there's inspiration that will maybe make them cry, but leave them at the end with a feeling that, hey, I can do this. I can go on.
Well, I think that's really such an important, important message. And, of course, you know, it's really amazing what you can do with a book. And I've never written a novel. I've written factual books. But, I think we all dream of wanting to do it. I, quite frankly, don't think I have the talent, but obviously you do. And, of course, how many books of fiction have you written now?
I have 15 novels, and one of them...
15 novels?
15 novels now.
Oh, how long did it take you to write one?
Well, that's something that I'm really blessed to be able to write quickly. We have 6 children, so I write usually from 9 to 3, and my husband's wonderful, so there are times when I do need to work in the evening or on the weekend. But it takes me, we don't want to tell my publishers this now, but it takes me probably 2 to 3 months to write a novel.
That's an amazing accomplishment to be able to do that, to be able to put it down the first time so it doesn't have to be gone over again and again and again and again and again, which is, I find, what I do.
Well, that's true. And, I think sometimes I find the faster I write, the better it is. If I can just get to the keyboard and download my heart, then it's kind of really comes out. I think part of that is the reason when I write, I see the scene happening. So the quicker that I can actually just sit there and just get it down onto that electronic piece of paper, the better it's going to be.
Well, of course, the computer gives you a wonderful ability to do that sort of thing. And but then, what do you do? Do you plan the whole story ahead of time? Do you know how it's going to begin? Do you know how it's going to develop? And do you know how it's going to end? Or is it that as you get into the story, this story begins to take a life on of its own, and the ending is something you did not anticipate?
Well, it's a little bit of both. I always have a plot. I always have an idea of where it's going. I can see the scenes sort of at the beginning and the middle and at the end. And then I sit down and I write a chapter outline, and I give myself permission to break that as I'm going along. That if, it's funny, I remember when before I was a novelist hearing, fiction writers say, well, I got to that scene and then that character just wouldn't let me do that. And I used to think, that's a little weird, and a little bit strange, but that is really how it becomes. The characters do take on a life of their own, and sometimes you do break what you've already created as your outline, but you still end up having, for me anyway, some structure, and some authors I know definitely just sit down and just start writing, and I'm not one of those.
Well, now, do you write from a woman's point of view? Do you write from a man's point of view? In other words, are your characters, your primary characters, men or women?
Well, they're both, and one of the things that people have said about my fiction, I have quite a few really very kind of avid readers of my fiction that are police officers and firefighters, and I think, these guy-type guys end up liking my books because I write in scenes, and so if I might be in this particular scene A, I might be in the antagonist might be a woman who I'm writing from her point of view completely. And the next scene might be a drunk driver, and he's on the mend and trying to figure out where his life's going. And it's a guy, and I'm writing from his point of view, and the voice is from his point of view. And a lot of the guys who read my books like them because I don't male bash. I have guys that are flawed. They're not your perfect knight in shining armor by any means, but they're not bumbling idiot type guys, which a lot of women's fiction type writers tend to do. And so, it's a balanced picture, and I get into everybody's head.
Well, of course, with a husband like you have, you probably don't want to be a male basher.
No, I have such a great husband, and that's true. I've had a very good experience, and, I have a strong compassion and sense of a real sympathy for women who don't have that experience. I've been really blessed with the man that I'm married to. But, I think my readers do tend to appreciate that the guys that I'm writing about are, they're good guys.
All right, fine. We're going to have to take a 3-minute break. And when we get back, if you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question or comment for our special guest this evening, Karen Kingsbury, why give us a call at 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and if you're out there in the listening audience, why, we hope that many of you will decide right now that you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters and partner with us in our effort to educate the American people, and educate them of the fact that there really is prejudice in the media, there really is an organized effort to influence what the American people think and ultimately to change our society. It's carried over into the educational process at the grammar school and high school and certainly in college to influence the outlook, shape the reality of our young people, and of course then launch them off into this life without values, without meaning, really in many sense a life of hopelessness, until they finally begin to understand that life does have meaning, that there is a God, and that, of course, they have to find their personal relationship with Him. But our job is to make people understand we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political and ideological and cultural battlefield. And if you agree with us that there is a problem, if you agree with us that America is standing at the verge of catastrophe, both fiscally and spiritually, and with this terrible war about to occur, we hope that many of you will decide right now you want to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. It's as easy as picking up your telephone and calling 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, I suggest perhaps our October newsletter, because it contains the testimony of Christian Breitwiser before the House and Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. Why, again, call 1-800-544-8927. We'll be glad to send you a September newsletter. You can have one or the other. We can't really send both of them, but the September newsletter goes into the background of what really happened on September 11th, who it was who really financed the Islamic terrorist movement, and, of course, what the terrorist movement's attack on the World Trade Center has promoted, and, of course, how our lives will change forever because of what happened on September 11th of last year. So if you'd like to get our information, why, again, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, 1-800-544-8927. Give serious consideration to going to our website, www.radioliberty.com, and pulling down our newsletters or pulling down our radio programs 5 hours a day, either directly off a Radio Liberty site or through the links, and then, of course, helping us to get the truth out across America from sea to shining sea. So, we'd love to hear from you. And, of course, if you have any questions or comments, you can always reach us through our 800 number, which, once again, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We're having that conference. Don't forget the conference. It's going to be on the 23rd of November at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course, and we hope many of you will decide to come. It'll be all day long. There'll be a luncheon. There'll be a syllabus. Doors will open at 8 o'clock in the morning and close at 6 in the evening, and we hope to see you there. Again, the 23rd of November, and the number 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America is under siege today. Well, Dr. Stan here, and our guest this evening is Karen Kingsbury, and of course she's an author, or she's trained as a journalist, but now she's found her place as a novelist, and she's written 15 novels. That's just unbelievable. Now, what are the names of some of the more recent ones that are better known?
Redemption is the one that...
I'm sorry, what is that?
Redemption. And that book is, I actually am writing the series with Gary Smalley. He's a relationship expert here in the United States and a strong Christian man. And he's lending his relational teachings to the series. It'll be a 5-book series, and book one just came out. It's been on the bestsellers list for a few months now. And this month also, A Time to Embrace just came out. That's a sequel to probably one of my most life-changing novels that I've written, and that's the book called A Time to Dance, which was about a couple who'd been married 20 years and now were ready to sort of throw in the towel and get divorced. And then it was really just a series of years of busyness and just distractions, and you know, you end up getting disillusioned, and next thing you feel like divorce is the option. And this couple had that situation, and and all within that same time frame, their daughter announced that she was engaged and going to be getting married. So it sort of plays the two off of each other, the memories of the couple who are ready to divorce and trying to keep that a secret, and then you've got the new couple who are experiencing love, and this is a Christian family, and too often, of course, you know, we do see divorces happening, and really not always for, you know, any kind of justifiable reasons. And so my goal with that book was that people would get to the end of it, and when that couple makes it, there would be a victory cry. Yes, they made it. Not a feeling of, here we go, another round with this guy. So that book has probably inspired most of the letters I have that are really amazing from people who have read my novels and have had their lives changed. I would say the majority are people who've read A Time to Dance.
Well, of course, this is such a problem today, and certainly one of the big problems is within the Protestant Church, why there's really nothing wrong with divorce. It's we've been told we live under grace, so, you know, we really are not going to be judged. We do something wrong. Right? We all do things wrong, and there really, of course, is no sense that God really wants couples to stay together. Oh, yes, we know divorce is bad, but, this is why the incidence of divorce is so terribly high within the Protestant Church. At least the Catholic Church comes out and says it's wrong, it's always wrong, it always will be wrong, and you can't get a divorce.
Mm-hmm.
But within the Protestant Church, we seem to think, well, since God loves us and he would never judge us for doing anything, and after all, you know, there must be something better. And after you've been married for a long period of time, a lot of the excitement of the blush of youth is gone, and the passion is not as it was. And you know, and so what is it that holds a couple together after their children are gone? And I think that's such an important issue to address today. Because, of course, a divorce is the worst thing in the world that can happen to either person.
It is, and also the family. And, I've got to share one letter that I got just recently. About 3 months ago, a girl named Amy, she was a 19-year-old college girl, she wrote to me in desperate tones in her email. She said she had read my book, A Time to Dance, and the story was very, very similar to what her parents were going through after being married for 20 years. And she said that she felt there was no hope, and they had already filed for divorce. The papers were done, and it was just days away from being final. But she was asking me if I would write to her mother, and if I would ask her mother to read my book, because she felt that her mother would not put any stock or any faith in the opinion of her 19-year-old daughter. And so here was this girl, and just saying, you know, I really feel like God wanted me to read this, and there's got to be a miracle here somewhere, and please, even though it may be just too late, please write to my mother. So I wrote to the woman, and I said, you don't know me. I'm an author, and your daughter is reading one of my books. But she tells me that, obviously, as you know, she's devastated about this divorce that you're going through, and, you know, I don't know your situation, and I'm sorry for the pain that is obviously taking a part of your life right now, but maybe the best way you could validate her feelings in this difficult time is to read this book. And I asked her to prayerfully consider that. Well, she writes back and she said, you know, thank you for caring. And she was a businesswoman, a controller of a company, actually. And she was, her letter was rather curt, but just, you know, yes, I will talk to my daughter and I will read the book. About 3 weeks later, Amy wrote again and she said, please, Miss Kingsbury, please pray because both my parents are reading your book. And then there was a period of silence, and I didn't hear anything for a few months. And Amy wrote to me, and she wrote just a week and a half ago, and she said, meant to get back a lot sooner with the terrific news, but I'm back at school. It's hard to find time. My parents are renewing their wedding vows on October 26th, one day after their 21st wedding anniversary. Thank you for your awesome book. Thank you for your prayers. This is truly a miracle.
Well, it's so gratifying to know that you've written something that can touch somebody else's life. And really, it's what a privilege it is to be able to do something of that sort.
It is. That's, for me, you know, a lot of people write surely for entertainment purposes, and that's fine. There's a place for that. But what I feel like God's called me to do at this time with our country where it is to write life-changing fiction, and that's the direction I'm going.
Well, it sounds at least that you've touched that one family, and I'm sure you've touched many other families, because this is such a common problem today. In fact, I did a series of actually interviews recently with a minister. Actually, he was a lawyer in Southern California named Charles Chrismeyer. And about 1992, at the height of his legal career, God called him out of the legal profession to become a minister. And so, of course, he's written a number of books about what's wrong with the Christian church today. And one of his points that he makes so vividly is that, of course, divorce. And, of course, this is a violation of God's law, and yet it's actually more prevalent within the Christian church than in the population as a whole. So, well, of course, you say, well, that's because of the general population. They're just not even bothering to get married. They're just living together. But that doesn't explain the tremendously high incidence in the Bible Belt, where it's almost 50% more than the general population. And somebody has to address this because the ministers aren't going to address it.
I think, you know, a lot of times what we're seeing maybe is a little bit of that, have a trickle-down product of people having the seeker-friendly church, where we talk so much about, you know, God loves us. Yes, that's very true. And, you know, God wants us to be happy. Well, I'm not sure I read that, you know, so much in the New Testament. God wants us to be obedient. God wants us to be holy and righteous and set apart for Him as we do that, of course, only in Christ's strength. But, you know, He loves us, and He wants us to, you know, to feel the blessing of His love and mercy. But I think sometimes we get kind of hung up on that point, and we very, you know, casually go through the divorce process thinking, well, God wants me to be happy. And I think we've really lost something when we get to that point.
Oh, boy, I think that you are right on there in this seeker-friendly church that doesn't want to ever make us lose any self-esteem by telling us that we're sinners only saved by grace, and that we better certainly look to the Lord for direction in everything we do. I think that we have changed the very nature of Christianity, and I believe that's why, of course, we're in so much trouble today in the church and in society as a whole, because society is supposed to reflect the church, and if society reflects the church, and I look at society today, obviously the church must be in serious trouble.
That's really true, and I really appreciate our pastor. His name is Bill Ritchie. He has a radio program that goes across the country pretty well, and he preaches from the Word. He doesn't care if it's going to step on some toes. Now, some people can accuse him of being a little, you know, the Rush Limbaugh of the pulpit kind of guy, but you know, he isn't called to be, for him, he isn't the warm fuzzy guy. There's others at the church that will, you know, that are counselors or better at ministering that way. But he really just sort of doesn't mince any words, and I appreciate that. I need that. I need to be called on the carpet and kept in the right direction. Otherwise, the temptations around us are all too great.
No, I think that's absolutely well. I obviously, your minister is my sort of fellow, because we need somebody who will say it as it is and not as people want to hear it. People really don't want to hear bad news. People don't want to hear that they're sinners. People don't want to know that God is not only a God of love, but He's also a God of justice and of judgment. Yes, and on occasion He's even a God of wrath. And, of course, they want to tell us, well, that's the God of the Old Testament. That isn't the God we worship, but, of course, God has never changed. We may want Him to change, but, of course, whenever we want to tell God how He's supposed to be, why, we're going to get into real, real, real problems.
Well, and, you know, I deal with some of that, too, within my books, and it's very rewarding for me to be able to do that, to be able to walk my characters through this very process.
Well, of course, you know, of course, you can actually, using fiction, get out a great deal of profound philosophy and profound truth. And, of course, that's what a great novel really does. It is not simply talking about adventure or incidents, but, of course, if it incorporates philosophy and eternal truths, then, of course, it can have an impact not only initially, but upon eternity.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. And you know, at Redemption, for instance, the first book in the Redemption series, I deal with, you know, some mindsets with the one daughter. It's a story about the series is actually about the Baxter family. So it's a doctor and his wife, and then their five young adult children, and it's going to follow their triumphs and tragedies and just situations as they kind of find their way out into the world. And, you know, the first book we deal with infidelity and some issues that are really along these lines of thinking about the seeker-friendly kind of church, and how, you know, you can convince yourself that it's okay to seek after a mistress if that's going to be something that would make me happy and make me feel blessed. And the professor husband in this particular first book feels that way, and it's wonderful through fiction to be able to show him, as time goes on, through consequences, through that still small voice that the Lord is trying so hard to get our attention, and to show that through fiction, the way that this goes, where it goes, that it goes someplace.
And of course, what we do has consequences. Actions have consequences, and you know, we can't sort of divorce ourselves from the consequences of our actions. And we may think we can do something in secret, but certainly God always knows. And even then, of course, it's going to have an impact on our families and really upon the people who are involved, because way down deep in their heart, they know what they're doing is wrong. I think we all have an awareness of what's right and wrong, even if we want to totally ignore that. Is that what your character does?
Well, you know, my character in this case definitely does a lot of ignoring initially, and then consequences come in and take their impact, make their impact on his life, and ultimately, again, we're doing our best to illustrate some of Gary Smalley's teachings on relationships with it. So ultimately, in this one, he sees sort of the error of his ways, and he tries to make a change, but I guess the surprise twist at the end ends up being that consequences are still there. And this is why we don't want to go down that path of just ignoring what Scripture tells us about sin, because consequences will follow us. Even redemption is there. Once we've been forgiven, that's a wonderful place to be, but the consequences will still be there.
And of course, you know, that is David found in the Bible, you know, and of course he had his affair with Bathsheba, eventually repented from that, but of course that did not do away with the consequences that not only affected Bathsheba and the loss of their child together, but his whole family was never the same after that.
That's exactly right, and that's, when I've had readers who said, oh, you know, I wasn't sure, I really liked the way that those consequences came down, and, you know, and many who actually, you know, agreed with the way that they came down, but the truth is, Scripture sets that pattern for us, that if we choose to go against God, we're going to pay a price for that.
Well, now, of course, was your decision as to how this story would unfold based upon simply the unfolding of the story, or did you, of course, refer indirectly to this, to the Scriptures, and, of course, what happened to David when he had sinned?
Well, I try to always do that, and I try to follow some, you know, and a lot of times the readers will pick it up and then pick up on that thread throughout, and sometimes they won't. I always have characters that are, you know, remembering a scripture that they maybe had read or had held on to at some point, or I have them, in a sense, feeling or hearing inside just that still small voice of the Lord. So I know I always include that, and it did in this case pattern that story, but it also was the natural consequence here. The way things played out, it's exactly the way they often will play out if you have a situation where someone takes this kind of a choice and detour from what God wants of their life.
Well, of course, it's far better if people read about it in a book and realize the consequences than if they have to live this and have to personally deal with the tragedy of the consequences.
Oh, that is just so true. I couldn't tell you how. I mean, that I have so many people who will read and will write to me and say that, you know, they're not Christians. They never thought about having a relationship with Christ, but they read this novel and it spoke to them, and so now they're able to see something. Now these are people that would not have picked up a apologetic or a nonfiction sort of a, you know, biblical approach look at, for instance, the issue of infidelity or cheating. But they'll read a novel. And, you know, we got that lesson, of course, first from Christ, who, when he wanted to touch a heart, he would tell a story.
Well, you know, I very often I find some young man as minister, 24, 26 years of age, just out of seminary. And I'm constantly amazed at how wise they seem to be. And you know, you talk to them, and their knowledge, their understanding, and of course, it's because they base their view of life upon God's word. And when you base your views on God's words, why, it's the fear of the Lord that's the beginning of all wisdom. And of course, isn't a shame that people can't really base their worldview on things of that sort, and they have to learn by experience all over again. And of course, there's no reason to have to learn by experience, because of course, you know, it's all spelled out in the Bible. All the frailties of men and the mistakes that they make, and the mistakes that women make as well, they're all there. If we could learn from those mistakes, we wouldn't have to make them ourselves. But a lot of people aren't going to sit down and read the Bible, but I guess they will read your novels, and if they get the message there, why, it serves exactly the same purpose.
That's right. It all works together that way. And you know, there's no question that I have to be connected to the Lord and to Scripture to be able to write the way that I can write. I wrote a book called When Joy Came to Stay, which was a story of a woman's struggle with depression. And that was not a story that really necessarily started in my heart like most of my novels. In fact, my agent said to me, hey, you know, we need a book dealing with depression out there. And I thought, well, maybe that'd be too depressing to write about. And I always have hope at some point in my novels. So I prayed about it and read some in the Book of Lamentations and, you know, came across the wonderful verse in chapter 3 that though the night may be dark and long, God's mercies are new every morning, and great is his faithfulness. So I went ahead and wrote a novel that has spoken to thousands of women about depression, about feeling freedom to sort of take the mask off of depression, be who you are. You don't have to put a mask on when you go to church. And just sort of stir compassion among those of us who haven't suffered from depression so that we don't have that, don't leave those people feeling alienated even in our church pews on Sunday morning. And, you know, people will say, where did you get that wisdom, or where did you, if you've never been through it, how did you write about it? And it's just God, completely, his word and that breathing into me and through me as I write, just a gift that he's given.
Now, how do they market the books? Because, of course, marketing Christian fiction, do they just put them in the bookstores, or are you able to get some sort of publicity so people's attention is drawn to your books?
Well, there, you know, it's this Publishers Weekly announcement that the inspirational fiction is the quickest growing genre in the publishing world. Opened a lot of doors. The Left Behind series opened a lot of doors to where now, you know, Walmarts and Costcos and, you know, supermarkets and Barnes & Nobles, all of them, they want a piece of what's going on, and they may not agree with it, and they may not like it. They may be more of that academia world that says, oh, can't have, you know, inspirational fiction, but it's selling. And so it's finding its ways into just about every facet of the mainstream market that you can imagine at this point.
Now, I understand that you have a website.
I do have a website.
It's KarenKingsbury.com.
That's right.
And somebody has obviously called in to let me know that, because it's up on my screen. So it's www.KarenKingsbury, KarenKingsbury.com. And what will people find when they go to the website?
Well, I want them to sort of feel like they're getting a chance to sit down with me and kind of get to know what I'm about and what my books are about. The opening page has 9 or 10 of my most recent titles in terms of the cover. So you can click the cover. You can find out more about the book. You can go to the section that says more about Karen. You can see about our family and our 6 kids. We adopted 3 little boys from Haiti. That story and its experience is written in one of the links there. And the guest book is a great place to stop in and just comment on what you think, if you've read one of the books, or to see what other people are saying.
I see. And so actually you can write in and give your opinion of the books?
Exactly. I have nearly 600 comments that are there at this point, and the website hasn't been up even a year yet. And people are, Gideon's Gift is a great example. It's a Christmas novella that just came out this month, and about a sick little girl and an angry homeless man and the gift that changes both of their lives forever. And I've had some people write in that say, I'll never be the same again after reading that. I'll never think of Christmas the same way, and thank you for that gift. So those kind of comments are all there.
Well, certainly one of the great novels of all time is, you know, Christmas Carol by Dickens. And because Christmas, of course, appeals to all of us. There's something about this time of year and the happiness that goes with it, the gifts, the snow. Of course, we have this picture where I live and we never have any snow. But this is the image that we have of the Christmas tree and of course, the happiness and the sleigh bells and Christmas is a time, certainly when I was practicing medicine, Depression, we always saw so many people with a depression. Christmas time, for many, many people, was a very unhappy time. But of course, it should be a happy time. And so you use your novel then to bring this story out of this little girl and this sort of miserable man.
Exactly. In fact, you know, one of the greatest compliments I've had some real good reviews that people said it's going to be a modern day classic or what, and I appreciate that. But the greatest compliment was that it is similar to A Christmas Carol, and you know, just the idea of the childlike innocence and Gideon, the little girl, and her determination that Christmas miracles happen to those who believe, and she's going to give this gift to Earl, the angry homeless man. And it's going to start off a series of miracles that only God and all of His glory in heaven could have orchestrated. And it's just 12 chapters. It's a Christmas novella. And, you know, something families can read out loud and enjoy. And it wouldn't surprise me if we get that made into a movie at some point.
Well, let's hope and pray that it does, because we need more movies that have this as a theme. And, of course, at Cloud 10 Films that people are putting out, that Tim LaHaye's movies, the second one's out right now, and they're really doing very well. There is a crying demand on the part of people for something that'll make them feel good and wholesome and has an emotional touch to it, will make them cry, will make them laugh, but will draw them closer to a feeling that life does have meaning. It's not this hopelessness that is portrayed by so much of what we see today.
Exactly, yes.
Well, would you like to, we're just about at the end of our program, do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners?
Well, I wanted to appreciate and just sort of say that I really appreciate what you're doing with your program and to really encourage listeners really to support this, because it gives us a voice. And like you said, it's a spiritual battle that's being waged on political entertainment fields. I mean, it's a lot of our sectors of the media that we look at. There's this spiritual battle that's raging, and it shouldn't surprise us, really. But we do need to bring it to light and make that something that we support in terms of a place like what you're doing with Radio Liberty. It's really important, and I'm grateful for what you're doing.
Well, thank you so very much, Karen. I hope sometime we're going to get you on again, perhaps one of our other programs. When I first, your publicist approached me, I thought, how can we talk for an hour? But I think we could probably go on for another hour. Anyway, the time is up. God bless you for what you're doing and for the lives that you're touching. And we each are called to play our own part. I mean, I'm on the radio. I can't write novels. You can write novels. But in the end, we're all trying to touch people's hearts and draw them closer to the Lord.
That's right. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Good night. God bless you.
And you too.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. That was Karen Kingsbury. I hope you enjoyed the program. A little different than a lot of them we do, but I hope that you'll go to her website, you'll get her novels, you'll read them, and that hope that they will touch your heart and draw you closer to our Lord. And so let me remind you that we hope that you'll pray for our ministry, you'll pray for our country, you'll pray for revival, but remember Radio Liberty in your prayers. Pray for our vision and our protection. And so until Monday at the same time when we'll be back with you, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.
thank you so much. And anyway, come to find out if you have a website.
Well, it was on my
Well, it was on your program.